This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. A change is coming into a historic part of downtown Hammett with the physical downsizing of Franciscan Health Hammett Hospital into a more compact facility. And that physical change will mark the end of a chapter in Hammett history and perhaps the beginning of another in the efforts to revitalize the neighborhood. I spoke yesterday with Patrick Maloney, the president and CEO of Franciscan Health Dyer Munster Hammond, and with the chairman of the healthcare organization's Northwest Regional Board of Trustees, Cal Bellamy. Maloney begins our conversation today with what Franciscan Health had noticed in recent years.
Well, we have historically been seeing our volumes getting smaller and smaller on the inpatient side, and that's a national trend for acute care, as well as taking care of these very aged buildings we have on our Hammond campus. And so last year, we actually asked for a comprehensive study of our facility's infrastructure. When the estimate came back, they said to keep this building viable for the next 10 or so years, it was going to require an investment of about $80 million. And that's just for boilers, air handlers, generators. That has nothing to do with clinical care. And at the time, we were at the height of COVID, we were losing upwards of $20 million a month in my division. And so when my CFO did a projection for the year, it looked like we were on a pace to lose $78 million. And at that point, we knew something had to change.
Mm-hmm.
So we contracted with Kaufman Hall, a national healthcare consulting firm. And they did a comprehensive study of the region, of the trends, where inpatient is going. And they looked at the capacity, and then they looked at our building, which we were probably only utilizing 30 to 40% of this building. And their recommendation was to cease all acute care operations here at Hammond. They felt that there's enough capacity in the region, and as more and more patients are being treated on an outpatient basis, they didn't feel this building was necessary. So at that point, we went to our board, both locally and at the corporate level, and we didn't want to leave the city. We knew that it would be perceived that we were abandoning this area, and that is not what we wanted to do. So I'll allow my chairperson, Mr. Cal Bellamy, to talk about what the board agreed to.
Okay, Cal, go ahead.
All right. Well, Patrick described some of the more recent studies. Actually, the Hammond campus has been under review for about 3 years because, you know, you have to have all three factors to have a successful operation. You have to have great patient care, you have to have employee opportunity, and you have to have financial sustainability. Without any one of those, there are none. The other two fail. So with the financial situation in Hammond, we had no alternative to do something. And the question was, what would we do? And so there were various alternatives and discussions. Do we spend a couple hundred million dollars and keep the facility as it is, but upgraded? Do we go to a mini hospital, which would have been about $80 million? Or do we drop down to the current proposal, which is still going to be about $45 million? So I don't want to sound like it's all dollars and cents, but the board has to balance financial sustainability. Otherwise, we don't have quality patient care. We don't have employee opportunities. So this was a difficult decision. I have three generations in my family of history with the Hammond campus. I helped raise funds for the building that we're going to be tearing down. So it's an emotional decision for me, too, but it has to be a decision made so that we can continue to serve our patients. And Patrick alluded to the fact that patients are coming less frequently to the hospital. The way medicine is going, hospital stays are very short now. And we're making a significant commitment to another type service, telemedicine. So that we can handle patients remotely in many cases. And again, that will affect hospitalization. So if we don't do something, we jeopardize everything.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the kind of thinking that the board went through. as I say, many discussions, many regular board meetings and special board meetings over an extended period of time, trying to find some way to maximize the use of the Hammond campus.
Speaking of which, and Patrick, maybe you can address this first. We know there have been changes to other facilities that Franciscan Health has, in particular in Michigan City. What is the difference between what happened in Michigan City with the facility that's up there and what is going to happen and the plans are for the Hammond campus?
Sure. At Michigan City, they made the decision to, what we're trying to do is regionalize healthcare and have comprehensive centers of excellence. And so having them concentrated in one facility. So Michigan City made the decision to put their brand new hospital right near the highway. And the old hospital went through a lot of discussion what it could be used for, because part of that building is not that old. And I was not privy to all those discussions. So I don't know exactly where they're going with that. But it's just a different situation up in Michigan City because they decided to build a new hospital.
Mm-hmm.
Here, we have our Munster facility that is a little over 2 miles south of 8094, and that's a much newer campus. So we have developed centers of excellence for oncology, for total joint, and even our gastroenterology there. So we are investing $46 million to stay here in Hammond, but we really needed the emergency room for the community, and then we have a small 8-bed medical unit as needed.
The old facility in downtown Michigan City would be comparable to the Hammond facility in the sense of geography. But to make that facility viable, it also is being reduced in size. Part of the original, we call it the legacy campus, is being demolished, and part of it is being preserved. It's the same kind of thought process as it was in Hammond. How do we maximize patient care, employee opportunity, and financial sustainability? We have a beautiful new campus right there, as Patrick said, at the Expressway and Michigan Avenue. But the legacy campus will still continue to serve patients for certain needs, but much of it will be demolished.
Mm-hmm. Now, where does the new facility that's being built in Crown Point come into play in all this?
Well, Crown Point, of course, is we have five hospitals in the northern region northern division of which I'm the chair.
Mm-hmm.
Hammond, Dyer, Munster, Michigan City, and Crown Point. And what Crown Point is going to be, we will be moving from the campus that we now have in Crown Point, and that land will be developed. It's in a good place for the city to develop it. We're moving out to I-65 and 231. That hospital's under construction right now. And that is a much broader vision. That is going to be a medical campus. There will be a great hospital there, just similar to the Michigan City Hospital. There'll be doctor's offices. There'll be St. Francis University training medical personnel, nurses. So it'll be a magnet on a regional basis. And Patrick mentioned the concept of centers of excellence. And the way healthcare is going these days, the procedures, if they're in the hospital, are more complex, more delicate, require high skill, and you can only reach that level of skill if you have enough cases. And so that's why we're trying to identify around our five hospitals where a center of excellence for cancer or for orthopedics or something else will be concentrated. Again, it relates to the quality of patient care.
Of course, the question now comes up, too, is about the history of the facility in Hammond. And we know that so far there's been a lot of comment, a lot of people that are lamenting what's going to happen to the old hospital in Hammond. I know some have said in a way that they see it kind of following along the same lines as what happened to Goldblatt's and Minas and the Hammond Times building and a lot of other structures in that particular region of historic downtown Hammond that will be at least in this particular case, it downsized, but still not going away, but still not the same as it was. And there are a lot of people who remember, and Cal, you mentioned this too at the first of our conversation about the fact that you have generations of family members that that have had some participation with the hospital, children born there, family members that have passed on there perhaps, but the idea is that there's a lot of history and a lot of sentiment in the old facility. It's going to be tough, I would imagine, to be able to move ahead out of all that, won't it?
Yes, and we're sensitive to the sentimental attachment people have to the Hammond campus, but unfortunately, they're all speaking in the past tense. They're not describing coming to the campus now. And so a hospital campus can't be a historical object. It has to be a vibrant, working entity. And if people have fond memories but aren't coming there anymore, that doesn't help a whole lot. So I think you have to keep that in perspective. Now, so far as downtown Hammond is concerned, the sisters completely support Mayor McDermott's efforts to revitalize the downtown area.
Mm-hmm.
And we are active participants in that. We have a large parking lot across Holman Avenue, the east side of Holman Avenue, very close to where the new South Shore station is going to be. We'll have land available on our present campus site that will be cleared. And all that land, we will be active participants in trying to get that developed and promoted to restore the vitality of downtown Hammond. Not that it'll be like it was, not a big retail center, but it the mayor has very nice plans, and as I say, we're anxious to participate.
Chris, may I add something to that?
Yes, please. Go ahead.
So when the city hired Jeff Speck to come in as a consultant on planning for the downtown, he talked about a walkable city, and I had a few meetings with him. And what he shared with me is that the most important thing that we could do for the walkable city is to provide as much property along Holman Avenue. And his idea and vision was to put townhouses there, because he said once you have residential and people are walking on the sidewalks, that's going to enable the downtown to grow. And with our future plans, that is exactly what we can do. And we'd love to work with the city and figure out how we can do some type of private-public partnership. We're going to have a three-story parking garage that's going to be right there in Ogden. We're going to have parking lots on Ogden. I mean, there's a lot of opportunity to really revitalize this with our plans and our $46 million investment.
Now, Patrick, if you will kind of wrap up our conversation with a little timetable as things stand right now about the status of the facility and the plans that are ahead.
So the schedule we have laid out now would have most of our acute care services consolidated to our other campuses by the end of August. But as we've said, it's subject to change. Right now, we're working with our staff and our HR to look at early retirement options. We've prepared an early retirement package for our employees 55 and over with more than 10 years experience. So they're sitting down to find out exactly what that would look like and working with our HR consultants and benefits. So that might take a little longer. We're also working on reassigning our staff to our other facilities. So there's a lot of boots on the ground right now. The preliminary is August. We also have Kindred, which is a hospital within a hospital, and their contract runs through November. So it's going to be a well-laid-out plan. It's not going to be rushed, and it is subject to change as, you know, things might change for us.
Patrick Maloney is the president and CEO of Franciscan Health Dyer, Munster, and Hammond. And Cal Bellamy is the chairperson of the Northwest Indiana Regional Division of the Franciscan Health Board. And gentlemen, thank you for joining us for the information and thinking back and thinking and looking ahead to the future. We appreciate you spending time with us today about it.
Thank you.
Talking to Patrick Maloney and Cal Bellamy about the plans by Franciscan Alliance to downsize part of the Franciscan Health Hammond campus and to convert the remaining over into an 8-bed acute care hospital, emergency department, and primary care location. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I would describe homelessness by, it can mean you are living in the streets, you don't have anywhere to go, or you're living from house to house to house, and you don't know when somebody's going to kick you out, you don't know when you might end up on the streets. When you go from couch to couch or house to house, you have no idea when that's going to be the last person. If there's ever going to be any hope that you're going to find your own place or find a job that's going to pay you enough money to get your own place, you never know what's going to happen. I mean, that was my family who was putting me into homeless shelters. I lost my mom when I was 17, and my brother was 14 when we were living in Hammond. She died of cancer. We didn't have a lot of family. We were losing the house that my mom lived in. My mom's husband walked out on us. My brother's dad was a drug addict and couldn't do much for us. Before I turned 18, I went to legal aid, and they were able to help me as long as my brother's dad was willing to sign over his rights. And he was. And I took custody of my brother when I turned 18. And we had got some life insurance from my mom in order to get a place, pay the first year's rent, and get him in school and get the furniture and clothes that he needed. It was really hard. We didn't have nobody else. I mean, our situation wasn't that great in the first place, considering my mom was an alcoholic and a drug addict. But when somebody looked at me and said I wasn't going to get custody of my brother, I had to get custody of him. I didn't want to lose my mom and my brother at the same time. It was a lot to take care of. He was a handful, especially after losing your mom. That's a traumatic stage to go through. And I understood because I lost her too, but he took it so much harder than I did that I couldn't wrap my hands around it, and I couldn't deal with it because I have my own emotional problems. And I'm like, how am I going to deal with your emotional problems when I have my own? I don't know what to do. And he didn't talk about it. He still does not talk about it to this day. He told me one time, he's like, I think it was better off that mom died. And I was like, why would you say that for? And he was like, because made us better people. He was like, if we would have stayed with our mom, then the situation might not have played out the same. She taught us everything not to do. That's the way we look at it. She loved us, but she didn't love herself enough to take care of us the right way like she should have. So she taught us what not to do. And I think we beat statistics pretty well. I had him for a year. And he didn't listen to me so well. I had to put him on probation because he had 80 truancies in school. It was just like two teenagers living with each other and fighting all the time. So he moved in with his friend's mom, and he graduated on honors. But I felt hurt, but I was okay because I knew where he was going. He was going to be okay. I'm very proud of him, and I think my mom would be too. It was after I took custody of my brother. We had our own place, but we lost it. My brother moved out, and then I went to stay with a friend, and I found out I was pregnant. And then that friend's mom kicked me out for no reason. I was 6 months pregnant when she put me out. I lived with her after my mom died, before we had got our own place. And I had got a little bit of life insurance from my mother after she died. And I was able to give her a lot of money at that time. So then when I had moved out and found my own place and we ran out of money, I moved back in with her and we didn't have the money no more. And so I was still providing food and cleaning up. It wasn't enough. Then I moved in with my son's father and his sister, and then she left to move to another state. So then I ended up moving in with my aunt, and this is all after I had Jaden, and we lived with her, and then she put me out, and she put me in a homeless shelter. She thought if I lived in a homeless shelter that it would help me get on my feet faster than me living with her. So that was her opinion of it. And not saying it didn't work, but the way she approached it, because she took my stuff and she sold it, or took it somewhere else and gave it to other people. So I was pretty upset. And it was my son's stuff too, like his walkers, his swings, all of that stuff. She took it and she just got rid of it because I couldn't come and get it because we were in a homeless shelter. So I think she could have handled that a little bit different.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. More than 100 million Americans have been vaccinated against COVID-19, and delivering each dose requires a complex chain of events. This is the story of one of those doses and how it ended up in Archie Thomas's left arm. Steve Berger reports for Side Effects Public Media.
Which arm do you want to receive this in? Left or right?
Archie Thomas is a church organist who grew up attending the Greater St. James Missionary Baptist Church in Evansville, Indiana. He still plays here occasionally. But on this warm spring day, the 49-year-old is visiting for another reason, to get his first shot of COVID vaccine.
Well, I do have a pre-existing condition, diabetes, so I thought it would be, you know, in my best interest to get vaccinated.
When he learned about the pop-up clinic at the Southern Indiana Church, he talked his mother, Elizabeth, into going with him to be vaccinated. She takes Archie's picture to record the big moment. That dose of Moderna vaccine is from lot number 017B21A. I wanted to trace its path, so I pieced together information from the CDC, the vaccine distributor, and health officials. Moderna wouldn't say where this dose was made, but it could have come from the company's big plant outside Boston or a partner facility. Next, it's shipped to McKesson, which handles distribution. The company has four warehouses where workers assemble kits of supplies and then wait for a shipping order from the CDC. That comes once Indiana Health Commissioner Christina Box requests the release of part of the state's weekly vaccine allotment. I asked her about it at a news conference.
We try to make sure that that vaccine is already designated to go to specific sites, so we're not trying to redistribute vaccine all across the state.
In the case of the Moderna vaccine lot we're tracing, that specific site is the Greater St. James Church. It's hosting a clinic staffed by the local health department, which brings us to the Vandenberg County Health Department in Evansville, where McKesson has shipped lot 017B21A. Clinical and Outreach Division Director Lynn Herr takes me into the secure vaccine storage area.
Well, I gotta wait for it because it's been open. So this is the freezer in which we put our freshly shipped Moderna vaccine.
The stand-up freezer is one of several holding various vaccines. And because Moderna's vaccine has to be stored at an extremely stable temperature, a timer keeps the door from being opened too often.
One day prior to one of our clinics, the lot numbers that we're going to use, we pull out of the freezer and it moves to a refrigerator.
So Moderna lot 017B21A is ready for the clinic at the Greater St. James Recreation Center. It's the final step that is the most difficult, getting people to sign up for the vaccine. I ask Archie Thomas about his own reluctance.
Do you have some concerns about it?
I did at first, but the church that I attend in Owensboro, Kentucky, Mount Calvary, Pastor Andre Bradley, he had a medical professional come and talk to us and give us some information about it, so I was a little bit more at ease.
So the church, in your case, played a role in you getting the vaccine?
Yes, sir, it did.
How important do you think that role is?
Being a faith-based Christian, it's good to have all kind of information, and you know, these are things that the church needs to talk about, you know, so they can be very proactive concerning health.
That hesitancy continues to be a serious problem. The local health department planned for over 300 people at this clinic, but it delivered just 11 doses. Because of the low response, Greater St. James Clinic organizers canceled an event to deliver the second doses of the Moderna vaccine. Archie Thomas and the others will go directly to the health department for their second doses. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Steve Berger.
Beneath the ground, right now, millions of small winged bugs are waiting. And sometime in the next few weeks, those cicadas will burst forth almost all at once. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Emma Atkinson reports.
Brood 10 is the group of periodical cicadas that emerges from the dirt once every 17 years to shed their crunchy exoskeletons, sing, mate, and usher their babies back into the dirt before the cycle starts anew.
I think there's no question that they're probably the most abundant insect in forests in North America, because you can get sometimes over 1,000 emerging out of just 1 square meter of land.
Andrew Liebhold says brood 10 cicadas are likely to appear in mass at the edges of forested land, mostly because they feed on liquid from tree roots. So if you have lots of trees on or near your property, you're likely to see most cicadas at the edge of the tree group or in a clearing.
If you have big broadleaf trees in your yard that are sort of open grown rather than closed canopy, the odds are probably pretty good you'll have a lot of periodical cicadas, because that's the habitat they like. They don't feed at all on conifers. So if you have a pine or a spruce, they don't feed on those.
You'll see them before you hear them. But when the song of the brood 10 cicadas begins, it'll be tough to hear anything else. The rattling and buzzing of their mating call is like a bendy straw. You know, the kind you'd stick in a milkshake or soft drink. Now imagine the sound it makes when you bend the ribbed part of the straw back and forth. A crunching, vibrating sound. That's basically the mechanism cicadas use to sing, as explained by Purdue University's exotic forest pest specialist, Elizabeth Barnes.
They don't have vocal cords like we do. They actually have this organ called a timbale on the side of their body that they contract, and that's what makes the noise. Most of their abdomen is actually hollow, so it's sort of like with something like with a violin, where you've got that hollow space that allows the strings of the instrument to make a louder sound.
And it can get loud, really loud. Bloomington arborist Jared Oren says it best.
I'm assuming if you were underground for 17 years and it's time to come out and, you know, make friends and populate, you would make a lot of noise as well. So it's going to be about 100 decibels.
Oren and his team at Bluestone Tree have been busy over the last few weeks preparing for the arrival of these insects. Not only is brood 10 noisy, but they can actually threaten the health of young trees. The female cicadas lay their eggs in small slits they create in horizontal tree branches. That won't affect an established healthy tree much, but younger trees could lose a significant amount of branches or even die if too many females use them to incubate their eggs. That's why some homeowners are covering their trees.
So you don't need to go all the way to the ground with this. You just need to go and bunch it up just around the branch where all the branches come out of the stem, because the cicadas are going to wrap. The cicadas are going to attach themselves to the underside of the branch.
Homeowners and businesses hire Oren and his team to outfit their young trees in gauzy fabric to keep the cicadas away.
Kind of just seeing how wide the canopy is going to be, and then draping it over and making sure that you can bunch everything up around the bottom without compressing the tips of the branches too much.
But if you're concerned about a young tree in your yard, you don't have to hire a service to prep it for the cicada onslaught. Oren says any fine mesh fabric will do, as long as it's white, to keep the tree cool in the sun. Painter's tape works just fine for securing the fabric to the tree's trunk. And don't worry about your vegetable garden. Cicadas prefer trees and will leave your tomato plants and herbs alone. All that's left to do now? Sit back and wait for the cicadas to emerge. Once they start, most will emerge within just a couple of days, and the singing won't be far behind. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Emma Atkinson.
That's it for Regionally Speaking. For today, I'm Chris Nolte. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we have a conversation with Lake County Surveyor Bill Emerson Jr. about the steps he and other people in Lake County government plan to take to preserve local wetlands after the new law that was passed by the General Assembly, a law that was admitted by some as controversial, takes effect. Hope you can join us for the conversation tomorrow.